This is Courage to Resist, bringing you the voices of the troops who refuse to fight. Samantha Schutz's recruiter told her not to say anything to the Army about her past depression and emotional problems, but almost immediately after she started basic training, those problems recurred. Samantha sought help and support from the Army and received none. Her emotional difficulties continued through AIT and her deployment to Iraq, where she worked as an Army journalist. What she did and experienced in Iraq deepened her opposition to a war that she had never believed in. Returning to the U.S. on leave, Samantha decided to go AWOL rather than go back to the Middle East. She is talking with us on the phone today from her home in Indiana. Thanks so much for speaking with Courage to Resist, Samantha.
You're welcome. It's my pleasure.
Can you talk about why you joined the Army back in 2006?
At the time, I was going through a lot. In April of that year, I had been in an inpatient program in my local hospital for a deep depression and kind of an inability to cope with society. I was having a lot of financial trouble, and my dream was really just to kind of go on the road. It sounds silly, but my biggest dream was to go work odd jobs and spread love and poetry and happiness all over America. And my family kind of was telling me that was impossible and that I needed to grow up and get a real job and get myself planted and rooted. And when I did sign up, I was 19 years old and breaking my third lease and have just come out of the hospital and very mistrustful of authority and felt like I had little to no options and that joining would be one of the only opportunities that I would be able to find to get some money together and make my family trust that I could be an active member of society, even though it wasn't what I wanted. And
well, the Army certainly markets itself that way, doesn't it?
Absolutely. I really feel that the advertising on TV hooks young people like I was into thinking that it's not a war machine. It's just a place to get money for college and to better yourself. And I kind of had a naive take on it all, but I think so many people do.
Now, you went to basic training, and from the beginning, I think, you had difficulties, isn't that right?
Correct. Almost as soon as I got there, within the first week, I was experiencing a lot of the same deep depression I'd dealt with for about 5 years solid before I went into the military, and here I was farther away from my support group than I'd ever been, and far away from my therapist, you know, having just a phone call once a week for support, and it was really a shock to my system. And
did you ask the Army for help?
I did. I saw a counselor, two times, and the first time I was basically told that I had already made a commitment to the Army, and my feelings at this point were just something that I needed to get over, and I needed to push forward. And, you know, I know they were just trying to motivate me, but I did not feel that I was being, that my best interests were being looked out for.
You weren't feeling any sense at all of support from the Army.
Right, not at all. And felt very alone. And so the next time I could, I called my grandmother and asked her to have some of my medical records sent from my therapist of 5 years and from the week that I spent as an inpatient. And even though those records were faxed to the counselor, counselor told me at our next meeting that it was not an option for me to use that as a way out, as she put it, because she felt that I had lied to get in. And the way she put it to me was, how am I supposed to believe that any of this is true when you lied just to get into the military? And it was hurtful to me because I knew that my recruiter had told me not to put that stuff on my application.
So the recruiter actually told you, don't tell the Army about your depression, your mental health problems, is that right? The recruiter said that?
Yes, that's right, and it should have been a red flag to me, but I believe that I was in such a vulnerable state that I pushed forward.
And then you had a counselor whose job it was obviously not to support you, but to support the Army and keep people in.
Yes, I felt it was a very one-sided deal.
So what did you do, Samantha?
Well, I pushed on. I also was dealing with a pelvic injury that I got the first week of basic, and I was on and off of crutches. And so I was disheartened through that. I didn't know if I was going to be recycled, as they say, having to repeat basic all over again. That was my biggest fear. I thought if I could just make it through that, maybe it would be easier to find a way to get help or get out when I made it to AIT.
And did you make it through basic the first time?
Yes, I did, fortunately. It took about all I had. I am proud of myself for pushing through that.
Well, you should be, given all the weight you were carrying around on your shoulders. You should be very proud that you made it through.
Nice to hear that.
Now tell me, what did you train for in AIT?
I went to the Defense Information School to learn how to be a print journalist.
And how long did that training last?
The training was 14 weeks. However, I was held over there because I was unable to pass the physical test due to my pelvic injury that was still following me from basic. I'd kind of made it worse.
But you finally did get out of AIT, and after that, where did you go?
I went on to Fort Hood, Texas.
And you worked in Fort Hood as a print journalist?
Yes, I was working at the division level for the general staff, basically.
What does a print journalist do at Fort Hood for the general staff? What was your work?
Well, I wrote a lot of articles about promotions and what was going on the base, and filler articles about safety, things like that.
Was there a base newspaper?
No, we submitted our articles to the two civilian newspapers that were near the base. They were army publications geared toward the soldiers at Fort Hood, but it wasn't our newspaper.
Now, while you were at Fort Hood, did your problems with depression get any better?
Actually, while I was still at Fort Hood, I was really kind of just feeling jaded about seeking help and feeling like no one was on my side and I needed to take a stand for myself, and that I didn't want to go to Iraq. And when our unit started talking about that, the pressure really felt like it was on me. And I decided in September of 2007 to go AWOL. And so I went on leave from Fort Hood, came to Indiana, to my home, and didn't go back. Unfortunately, I wasn't aware of how many resources were out there. I felt at the time very alone, and some of my family were supportive. Other people were not, and I still wasn't very sure of myself or what I could do. So I was still communicating with my superiors in my unit, and we had a lot of phone conversations in which I was very expressive of my feelings. And my commander of my section commander, my boss, he assured me, promised even, that if I came back, he would personally help me seek a discharge if I just came back. And I believed him, and I returned to Fort Hood after a week of being AWOL, and all that really happened from that was my being AWOL was swept under the rug. They subtracted those 7 days from my accrued leave, and no one ever talked about it. I did not get punished for that. I did get to have a conversation with the first sergeant of my unit, in which I was very frank about everything I had been feeling and was feeling. And he again enforced the idea that I had learned in basic that I have made a commitment, and it did not, my feelings did not matter. What mattered was honoring the contract that I had signed.
Now, you mentioned that you started hearing talk about your unit deploying to Iraq. Along with your emotional turmoil, did you have any feelings about the war in Iraq and what the mission was, about what the U.S. was doing there?
I definitely did have feelings about that. I have had feelings about that before I joined, that my friends and family knew that I had, and that was part of the reason why people encouraged me not to go. And I hoped to be proven wrong, and was proven right.
Okay, so back to your AWOL. You left Fort Hood because you weren't getting the kind of support you needed, and also because you were troubled by the possibility of participating in a war that you didn't believe in. Is that right?
Yes, you are correct.
So your commander talked you back to Fort Hood. They swept your AWOL under the rug, took off 7 days from your accrued leave, and there you were again. What happened then? How did you feel?
I felt defeated. Looking back, hindsight's 20/20. I wish now that I would have been more aware of some of the resources that I had to help me. And I'm glad now that I've learned to be a stronger person and really asserting my beliefs about things. But I allowed this situation to make me feel defeated and like I couldn't accomplish anything. So I just kept going through the motions, and then the next thing I knew, I was waking up on a plane to Iraq, to Kuwait, and then to Iraq.
And you were in Kuwait, what, a few weeks before you went into Iraq?
Yes, I think we were there 2 or 3 weeks.
And where did you go in Iraq? Where were you stationed?
I was at Camp Liberty in Baghdad.
Were you still working as a print journalist?
Yes, I was.
And your mission there was to do what?
My mission there was basically the same as it had been in Fort Hood, except now we had our own publication. However, I did not feel that I was a journalist. I felt like I was a propagandist, if I can be honest. I felt like it was drilled into my head, all of our heads, that we were to put a positive spin on everything, and there were only certain things that we could report on. And another part of our job there was to work with the Western and media to guide them, and when they would come over and embed to get stories. We kind of, in a roundabout way, censor what they were allowed to see and experience and write about or film.
Now tell me how that worked. What did you do to accomplish that kind of before-the-fact censorship?
Basically, we would organize what missions they would go out on, and we knew in advance what missions were likely to see violence and what missions were goodwill missions or building missions or, you know, things like that. And we would send the media, you know, out on the goodwill missions and not mention the violent ones.
And in terms of what you yourself had to write, did you write things that you felt were outright lies, or was it a matter of spin, or of looking for something positive in the midst of all the negative? How would you characterize it?
For my part, I was at the division level, and I was a female, so I wasn't allowed to go out on many of the more dangerous missions. But I feel that for my part, my assignments seemed to be centered around ignoring what was going on and just trying to fill space and entertain.
So nothing of what you would think of as genuine journalism in which you were reporting information about what was going on that might have been uncomfortable for the people in power.
Right. It was another example of my naivety being preyed upon, because I really thought, I'm going to be a war journalist, and that I'm going to be covering this event in history that is controversial. And it's come to find out, I always knew the media was a little biased, but I did not feel like reporting the news was anything close to what I ever did.
So you must have felt very disheartened by that.
Extremely, and I actually brought that to the attention of some of the people, some of my colleagues, and the superior, and what happened was they moved my position, so I was no longer writing. My function now was to be the editor of our newsletter, our daily newsletter. And so my job now was a 12-hour shift at nighttime where I essentially worked alone and just put together this newsletter, and it was a lot of like busy work and cut and paste, and I think they may have thought that I was a danger at that point, or they may have just sensed that I was under motivated.
It sounds to me as if you were being punished for speaking your mind.
I believe that as well. I felt that way, you know. I was alienated from the rest of the staff. Working alone, 12 hours a night.
Now, at that time, how were your spirits? How was your depression? How were you dealing with all this emotionally?
At that time, I had reconnected with an old friend over the internet, so it was easing up as far as the depression, because I had someone that I could relate to, that I was able to talk about things and get my emotions straight. But I was losing a lot of sleep, and I was tacking on all these other emotions of, you know, guilt. I've always kind of considered myself a little bit of a bleeding heart, and I had gone out on missions into these neighborhoods of Baghdad and seen the way that people were living, and then come back and to the American base in the middle of that, and I come back to my air-conditioned nice trailer with my nice bed and TV and refrigerator and microwave and computer, and then if I wanted, I could walk a half a mile down to Taco Bell, Burger King, Popeye's Chicken, Cinnabon, a PX the size of a Walmart. I was feeling more depressed and guilty because I felt the American public was being told that we were over there now to help them rebuild, recuperate, and I just wasn't... It was stunning to me how much money, $12 billion a month in 2008, you know, being spent over there, and seemed, in my eyes, to be going more to our creature comforts than actually helping.
So your conscience was troubled.
Absolutely. And it was hard for me to deal with already being depressed. And I also even got to the point where I was being irresponsible with my money because I did not feel that my conscience didn't feel that I deserved that money, because it was coming from taxpayers who were being, you know, were having the wool pulled over their eyes. I felt by being part of the military organization that I was deceiving the American people, and it was horrible.
It must have felt really bad for you. I can tell from how you're speaking right now, you're a person of deep feeling, and obviously this was tremendously troubling to you. Now tell me, when did you come back from Iraq?
My leave was in July, this past July, 2008.
And what did you do when you were home on leave?
Well, I had sort of knew, I've sort of known before that, that I may not return from leave. I had kind of prepared myself to make the decision when I got home as to whether I was going to return or not. And when I came home on leave, I felt that conversations that I had and things that happened in a way encouraged me not to go back. And I felt that I had no moral choice in the matter. I could not continue doing that. Knowing that I had 3 more years still on my contract, that I would be going back and doing that again, I needed to end it right where it was. So
you stayed home.
Yes, I stayed in the States. I actually traveled with my current partner. He and I traveled to work out west on an organic farm, and it was like a complete 180 from what I had been doing, and I knew then that it was possible for me to really be happy and to have a life where I was a functioning member of society and I was able to live simply and take care of my finances and still do something that I don't feel is morally wrong.
Wow, you did a lot of growing up in a hurry.
I don't regret that aspect of it, but I wouldn't recommend it.
Yeah, it's pretty intense, everything you had to go through. Now, you went out west, but today we're talking to you at your family's home in Indiana, is that right?
That's correct. After going west, we did a little more traveling around there and traveled back here. We had actually found out that I had gotten pregnant, and so I wanted the best possible care for myself and our family. So I wanted at that point to see about turning myself in and taking accountability for all of this and, getting it behind me. So we came back to Indiana so I could prepare to do that, and I found out that I had miscarried. And so I went through another emotional period, and this was in September 2008, a year after the first time I had gone AWOL. And so I went through another long emotional period, but I still drove. I was actually going to Fort Sill, Oklahoma to try to go that route. I still hadn't done all my research and used all my resources at that point. I was kind of going blindly into it, and that's what I realized when I stopped at a hotel for the night. I realized that, you know what, I'm trying to fight this battle all by myself, and I know that this is not the right time or place to be doing this, and intuitively I didn't feel right about it. So I came back home, and my partner and I decided to do some more soul searching and traveling. So we went west again. I had kind of been battling with, well, do I even want to go back, or do I just want to, you know, never face this and kind of like live under the radar? And I ultimately decided no. Part of what I want to do is have my voice back and be able to help other people heal from their wounds from the war machine, you know, and stand up for themselves too. So I got the courage again to come back and work on turning myself in. And that's when I finally got, I had called the GI Rights hotline before, but this time they finally recommended me to the lawyer that I have. And the lawyer that I have recommended me to your organization. And so I finally felt that it was the right time and place to where I was going to be supported and doing it for the right reasons and have more of a control over the situation.
Well, I am so impressed with the thoughtfulness and intelligence and humanity you have brought to this decision. You're a pretty amazing human being. Now tell me what the situation is right now. Where does everything stand?
Well, right now, I know that the range of consequences is anywhere from a discharge, a less than honorable discharge, and kind of like a, okay, well, you're not worth it. We should have let you go a long time ago. You know, we're not going to even deal with you. All the way to serving another 7.5 months instead of in Iraq in, like, a brig, military brig.
And do you feel prepared for that more severe consequence?
Honestly, I had already prepared myself for even worse. I was prepared. I honestly can say that I would rather spend the 3 years that I still have left on my contract in a cell than serving this organization. It's not what I would want for anyone or myself, but yes, I am prepared for that.
Well, that's a powerful statement, Samantha. I'm extremely impressed. Tell me, what's your situation? Have you turned yourself in? Are you still AWOL?
Right now, I'm working with my lawyer. He is going to start mediating between myself and my unit. My unit actually just returned earlier this month from Iraq. So it's a little intimidating knowing that, you know, they may be resentful. Certain people may be resentful toward me. But anyway, my lawyer's going to be working between us and kind of negotiating my return. And so, yes, right now I'm trying to still lay low and work. You know, I trust my lawyer and I trust my story. And I hope that it gets over and done with as soon as possible. I've been ready, you know, for a few weeks now. And
well, I'm just so moved by your story, Samantha, and by your honesty and your determination and your integrity. We're going to do everything we can to be supportive of you here at Courage to Resist, and I think when other people hear you speak, they're going to be supportive of you as well.
I really appreciate the kind words, and I, you know, am so grateful for what you guys do. I can't even express it. You know, I cried looking at that website of that whole list of people, knowing that I wasn't alone. You know, I just...
You're definitely not alone. There will be people all over the world who will hear your story when we put it up on our website, and who will, I think, be as moved and touched and impressed as I have been talking with you. Like all resistors, you're standing up for what you believe is right, and there's nothing more powerful.
Thank you so much. Again, I really appreciate it.